Trumos, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Aleph. We start a new Perek now, the seventh Perek, and unlike the sixth Perek where we were talking about the consequences of eating Truma b'shogeg, inadvertent consumption of Truma, by one who's not permitted to eat it, here we talk about consuming Truma b'mezid, intentionally eating Truma, and the consequences thereof. So really there are three potential consequences. The first and most basic is that one who eats Truma, who wasn't allowed to eat Truma and did it on purpose, he's taken that which didn't belong to him. He's destroyed it. So just the same way if I break into your backyard and take your bottle of wine and pour it down the drain, so then you'll demand that I repay you for the cost of losing your wine. If I take your bottle of Truma wine and pour it down my throat, I'll have to repay you for the fact that I've taken your Truma wine. So that's the most basic point here, that one who eats Truma intentionally has to make compensation to the one whom he damaged. But that, of course, is quite different than what we said in the previous parak, which we also had the issue of what I called the conservation of Truma in the world. They have to reconstitute Truma and make new Truma from Hulin. And there's also an atonement process that it's achieved by giving the Chomesh. None of that applies over here. When it comes to eating Truma b'mezid, so the Torah does not afford the sinner the opportunity of simple atonement by just repaying and giving an extra chomesh. That won't do. He'll have to repay because he took which wasn't his. But in terms of his atonement process, that's between him and Hashem. He'll have to do tshuva and do what he can. He can't do more than that. Now, the second consequence is misa b'dei shemayim, which is literally death at the hands of heaven, so that's premature death, and that applies as well. One who eats Truma illegally will suffer those consequences, God forbid. And in addition, there's the possibility of malchus, of lashes. So in general, when one violates a law from the Torah, prohibition from the Torah, like eating Truma when you're not allowed to, if one does it intentionally and he has Edim and Hasra'a, witnesses and sufficient warning, that is, say, two kosher witnesses put him on notice and say, if you eat that Truma, you'll be suffering the consequences of lashes in this case, then if a person says, I don't care, and does it anyways, the Vezdin, the court, will be able to confirm that he understood the consequences of his actions because he was put on notice, he acknowledged them, and he did it anyways, and therefore he suffers the consequences, which in the case of eating Truma as a non-Kohen is to get lashes. Now, that will apply if and only if there were Edom and Hasra, there are witnesses who gave him proper warning. If there were indeed witnesses who gave him proper warning and the court imposes lashes on him, so then the Bartanura says the halacha is like the Rambam, who paskins that when it comes to one act which incurs two potential penalties, one of financial compensation, like repaying back the truma that you ate, as well as corporal punishment, getting lashes, so then one just gets the lashes and does not end up repaying. So it's an either or, and the lashes get priority. That's the Rambam paskins, and let's assume that's the halacha. So our mission now picks up from that point, assuming that there were no sufficient witnesses or warning, and therefore we're not going to talk about lashes here. We're going to talk about the consequences of eating Truma b'mezid without witnesses, which then will, of course, mean making regular financial restitution to the victim from whom you stole the Truma, or damaged it, or lost it, whatever it is. And this would be applicable across the board. It doesn't matter now if you'd have consumption in the conventional sense, as you recall from the sixth parak, to have tick the box of being ochel truma b'shogeg that requires the keren v'chomesh payment. It has to be eating in a way that's consumption, as is normal, as opposed to wasting or destroying. For example, if you anoint your skin with grape juice, you'll recall there was no keren v'chomesh payment because that's really destroying as opposed to eating the grape juice. Here it's not like that at all because it's just simply a point of you're damaging that which doesn't belong to you. So if you don't eat it, of course, you won't get the consequence of misa b'dei shemayim, but you would have the payment, the regular compensatory payments, like as even if it weren't truma, as if you broke into someone's backyard and took their bottle of wine and poured it down the drain. So the Mishnah says inside, ha'ochel truma mezid, if one eats truma intentionally, knowing he's not allowed to, but does it anyways, so then, assuming there are no witnesses, sufficient witnesses and sufficient warning, then mishalim esa keren v'ena mishalim esa chomesh. He must pay back the principal that he cost the original owner, the Kohen who owned that Truma, but he doesn't need to pay back any Chomesh payment. In fact, he's not allowed to, and his Chomesh payment wouldn't help him to get atonement. So he has to pay back what he took. And that repayment, since its basic nature is simply monetary, first of all, the payment is based on the value of the Truma itself. So in other words, if you recall, we said that Truma goes for a less price, a lower price in the marketplace than Chulin does, because Truma is less desirable, only Kohanim can eat it, they can only when they're Tahor, and it's susceptible to becoming invalidated as when it becomes Tame. So no one really would choose to have Truma over Chulin, therefore the prices are lower. So the repayment price is made based on the value of the Truma that was lost, whatever that might be. More than that, it's not made in foodstuffs necessarily, just made based on a return of value. Because unlike we had in the previous parak where you were eating it b'shogeg, we were going to have to pay back in chulin musukanim, in regular tithe food, which then, when you give it to the Kohen, becomes truma midoraisa all over again. So you reconstituted the truma that was lost in the universe. Here, no such thing. You basically have to pay back what you stole or damaged, and that's a simple financial obligation. So you'll basically can cut the guy a check or give him cash. No need to pay in food stuff, chulin, whatever it is. And therefore, the Mishnah says, "Hatashlumin chulin," what you pay back, even if it would be foodstuff, remains chulin. So if you're like bartering, you're giving him something in food in kind, it stays as chulin, it doesn't become truma. Imratza kohen limchol mochel. And if the kohen wants to forgive the financial debt that you owe him for damaging or stealing his stuff, he's allowed to do so. This is in contrast to the case we said in the previous perek, where one eats truma b'shogeg. In such a scenario, the kohen is not allowed to forego the repayment because the Torah mandates it. Kind of again like my conservation of truma theory. You have to reconstitute truma in the world. Here, there's no such thing that you've damaged the truma and you're not afforded the opportunity to reconstitute the truma. It's just simply you owe the kohen for what you damaged and what you took. And that being the case, if he doesn't want to take your money, so just keep your money to yourself, you good for nothing thief. He's totally at right to do so. And you owe him nothing after that, of course, and you still, either way, will have to deal with Hashem with achieving atonement. Trumos, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Beis, 7-2. More on the illegal consumption of Truma, but here we're focused on the halachas of a Bas Kohen. That is to say, a woman who, her father is a Kohen, but she, of course, is free to marry whom she wants, and she's allowed to marry someone who isn't a Kohen. Now, when it comes to the halachas of Truma, the person who is allowed to eat truma is the Kohen, and all the members of his household, which would include his wife or his daughter. Now, women may have some connection to being Koheneses, if you will, in their own right. That is to say, the prohibition against eating truma applies to a zar, or a zara, meaning someone who is foreign to the Kohuna. And a Bas Kohen is certainly not foreign to the Kohuna. She's a member of a Kohen's household, and she always has been since the day she was born. The issue, however, is that because a woman who could start being a Bas Kohen and eating Truma her whole life in her father's home could marry a non-Kohen, and at that point become part of a new home, a new household, and at that point becomes ineligible to eat Truma because she's now part of a new home and a non-Kohen home, we have to consider the considerations about what happens in various scenarios where she marries, and then she could potentially even become altogether disallowed from eating truma permanently. So under normal circumstances, you have a Bas Kohen, she eats truma until she gets married. When she gets married, if she marries a non-Kohen, so then she stops eating truma, she's forbidden to eat truma. She's not a Zara, because she always could go back to her father's home. That is to say, if her husband dies, then she reverts back to being a member of her father's household, assuming she has no living children. If she has living children from her non-Kohen husband, so she started a new home of her own, and that new home will persist, and she remains someone who can't eat truma by virtue of the fact that she has children from her late husband, who was not a Kohen. But even then, by the way, if those children would all die in her lifetime, so then she would once again become permitted to eat truma as an extension of her father, the Kohen's household. Now, that's straightforward enough, and for that reason alone, the first sheet to hear will say very straightforwardly that once a Bas Kohen, on some level always a Bas Kohen, because you always can go back. However, it gets a little tricky if the woman who was a bas kohen marries someone whom she was not allowed to marry according to Torah law. So there's two possibilities. First of all, if she marries someone who the Torah prohibits to her, let's say a mamzer, which means no woman can marry a mamzer, or she marries a Mitzri or a Domi or a Nasin, someone who, again, the Torah or rabbinically she's prohibited to marry into one of those nations, such a woman becomes what's called a zona, which in modern Hebrew is not a very polite word, but it's a term of art, a technical term in the Torah. And if she's a zona, or if she marries, or really even has relations, I should say, really, forget marriage, has relations with someone whom she's forbidden to have relations with because of the rules that restrict Kohanic marriages, like, for example, if she is a divorcee and she marries a Kohen, or she marries someone called a halal, I'll get to in a second. So she becomes a halala. That means someone who's been emptied out of their Kohanic status. And as a halala or a zona, she is ineligible forever to go back to being eating truma. So she can divorce herself from the kuna, if you will, by either by marrying in such a way where she can't go back to her father's home, or marry another Kohen. At least we'll see that's how the sheet is in the Tanna Kamma. And so that's the lay of the land here. So now, and a halala is a halal. If she marries a halal, that's a person who is the offspring of one of these relationships between a Kohen and someone with a Kohen who a Kohen couldn't marry because the rules of the restrictions on Kohanim apply to that particular marriage. In other words, if a Kohen marries a divorcee or a zona, so then their child will be a halal if it's a male, and if a woman marries a halal and she was a bas kohen, she becomes a halala and no longer is ever eligible to eat truma. There'll be machlokas in our Mishnah if such a woman is still considered a zara, if she's foreign to the kuna now forevermore, or not, because she could go back if she didn't become a zona or halala, but you can't afterwards. Okay, that's the backstory. Let's see the Mishnah inside here and how it plays out. So it says, the first sheet is Reb Meir. He holds, Bas Kohen Shenisses Li Yisrael. You have a regular daughter of a Kohen who's could eat Truma, who marries a Yisrael, a non-Kohen. So now she becomes ineligible to eat Truma, but she's not, as we'll see in Reb Meir in a second, she's not a Zara, she's not foreign to the Kohuna, because, like we said before, she could end up getting divorced from this fellow and marrying another Kohen, or she can go back to her father's home if she has no children from this non-Kohen husband. So, va'acha kach achla truma, if she then, after marrying the non-Kohen, eats truma, so mishalemes es a karen ve'en mishalemes es a kochomesh. So she did something wrong because she was not entitled to eat truma, because she's not part of a Kohen's household, and therefore she'll have to make restitution. However, she's not a zara, she's not a zar from the pasuk, foreign to the kuna, and therefore she won't need to pay the chomesh. And actually what that means is, she doesn't have to, when she repays, she's paying simply as one who took something which didn't belong to her. In other words, the truma belongs to the kohanim, and she's no longer a kohanis, so therefore, when she ate the truma, she was essentially stealing from the kohen, and therefore she has to make restitution. But that restitution is like any other thief, meaning what she'll pay back is simply the value of that which she ate. There's no reason to pay back using chulin musukanim, food that becomes truma. If she does, it won't become truma. There's no need for a chomesh payment, as the Mishnah said explicitly. She's simply paying based financial compensation. Fine. Separate issue altogether here. A woman who commits adultery is subject to capital punishment, a death penalty, assuming that she had sufficient legitimate witnesses who gave her proper notice that if she would indeed perform that act, she would be liable to the death penalty, and they explained to her what could happen, and she says, I don't care, I'm doing it anyways. So at that point, she is subject to the death penalty. However, there's two different prescribed death penalties that differentiate a bas kohen from a non-bas kohen. The bas kohen's mode of execution is called sreifa, and the non-bas kohen, every other woman's mode of execution is called chenek. Okay, I don't get into the details of what those are right now, they're off topic. But anyways, the question therefore is, if a woman who was a bas kohen marries a Yisrael, meaning a non-kohen, so she becomes part of that person's household, and then she commits adultery, so she's liable to, under the proper circumstances, she's liable to execution. So which execution should she get, the mode of a bas kohen or non-bas kohen? So Reb Meir says, misasa b'sreifa, she gets the sreifa mode of execution, which is the one that a bas kohen gets. Meaning, even though she married out to a non-kohen family, she's always a bas kohen, and therefore will be liable to the misa, the death penalty of a bas kohen. These two sheets are consistent, of course, meaning the first opinion regarding her ability to not be such, not a zara and not subject to the penalties of chomesh, etc., for eating truma, even if she marries a non-kohen family, and that she gets the penalty of sreifa as opposed to chenek, even though she married a non-kohen. They're consistent, but they're actually learned out from two different psukim. They're not totally interdependent one on the other necessarily, but they go together. Nisas le echad mikol ha-psulim, if such a woman, the bas kohen, marries someone who she's not allowed to marry, someone who renders her pasul. Again, either she could become a zona by marrying a mamzer or a nasin or a mitzri or a domi or moavi, or she could become a chalala by marrying a chalal or by being divorced and marrying a kohen or being a widow and marrying a kohen gadol. That would all render her to be a chalala. In all those cases, so then, according to Rabbi Meir, Mishalemes Keren V'Chomesh U'Misasa B'Chenek, everything changes. Since she defiled herself in a way that she can never go back to her father's home anymore and eat truma, and she can never marry a Kohen anymore, that being the case, so now she becomes a Zara, according to Rabbi Meir, divested of her, emptied out of her Kohenic status forever, and that being the case, she's a Zara, so if she eats truma, now, as a chalala or zona who ate truma illegally, she'll have to pay back like any other zara, meaning she's mishalemes keren v'chomesh, like anybody else. She pays back with the food stuff that is chulim sukanim and it becomes truma. She adds a chomesh, etc., like everyone else. That was the point of Rabbi Meir here, is that a zona or a chalala becomes a zara and is no longer, and like everybody else, she's foreign to the kohen altogether. Umisasa b'chenek, and the death penalty she faces, if after she becomes a zona or a chalala, she then has an adulterous relationship, so then she's subject to the death penalty under the requisite conditions of any other non-Kohen. She loses her bas Kohen status altogether, according to her mayor, and gets chenek instead of sreifa. Again, these two factors about not eating truma and the mode of execution are consistent, but they're actually based from different psukim. That's Ivrei Meir, Rav Meir Shita. The Chacham, however, disagree, and the Halacha follows them. Chacham Omrim, Zu v'zu mishlemes es ha-keren ve'enu mishlemes es ha-chomesh. They say it doesn't matter if a Bas Kohen married a Yisrael, it doesn't matter if a Bas Kohen became a Zona or Chalala. In all those cases, she's still not a Zara because she came from a Kohen. And that being the case, she's never totally foreign to the Kohuna, even though she won't be able to go back again necessarily, to marrying another Kohen or her father's home and eating truma because she became a zona or a chalala, but notwithstanding, she's not a zara, and therefore, if she eats truma inadvertently, so then she will b'shogeg, so then she will have to pay back. Even if she ate it inadvertently, she'll only pay back as someone who took something that didn't belong to her and make financial restitution and not be subject to the Keren V'Chomesh requirements of a zara or a zar, because she isn't one because she came from a Kohen, says the Chachamim. Umisasim b'sreifa, and similarly, actually based on a different pasuk, like I said before, but it's consistent, that the Chacham hold that every Bas Kohen, regardless of whom she marries and with whom she has adultery, etc., it doesn't matter, she's got the Bas Kohen status from beginning to end, based on that pasuk, and she will be subject to the execution known as sreifa, regardless. Halacha again, like the Chachamim.
Trumos Perek Zayin, Mishnah Gimel, 7:3. Hamachel es banav ketanim. If a person feeds truma to his children who are minors, meaning you're talking about here children who are not bar bar mitzvah, and of course the children are not kohanim. So you're feeding them truma, and they're not chayv in mitzvahs, and maybe they're actually because the pasuk says ve'ish ki yochel kodesh b'shkaga, the pasuk which specifies one who eats truma b'shkaga is referring specifically to an ish, an adult, as opposed to a child. Perhaps that's the drasha here also. There's a different shittas on if it's the generic exemption of children or the specific exemption of this pasuk on children. Either way, the point is these children are not going to be paying keren v'chomesh because they're children. And you aren't going to be paying keren v'chomesh because you weren't doing the eating of the truma. You're simply feeding it to them. So in such a case, you might have to make financial restitution to the Kohen because you took that which wasn't yours, just as if you would have poured that food down the drain or into your goat's mouth or something, and you have to reimburse what you took. But it won't be returning chulin b'sukan, it won't be paying a chomish and so on. And the children similarly won't pay because they're just children, either, again, the generic exemption for children, or that the pasuk specifically excludes children. Same goes of es avadav, ben gadol, ben katanim. If a person feeds his eved, his servants, his slaves, these are non-Jewish slaves, whether they're grown up, meaning whatever, older or katanim, or their children, it doesn't matter. In both cases, again, he who fed his slaves will have to reimburse the Kohen for taking that which wasn't his, but the slaves won't be making any restitution to the Kohen, even though they're forbidden to eating this truma, because they're not the slaves owned by a Kohen. The reason, however, here is very different. Here it's simply a matter of, when it comes to a normal Eved, an Eved Kanani, a non-Jewish slave, so they have no hand of their own, so to speak, with which to own financial assets or any assets. So that being the case, there's no way for, under normal circumstances, for an Eved to have money, and therefore he couldn't pay back because he's penniless. Is that the normal setup? of course, if that Eved would ever be freed, so then if he wants to get the Kapari, he'll be required now to give Keren V'chomesh. And similarly, if one engineered, he contrived a strange case where a person was a benefactor to a Eved Kanani, a non-Jewish slave, and he gave the money with the right halachic stipulations, which said that this money should not become the property of the owner of the slave, rather be the slave's property with which he could pay back the Keren V'chomesh. So in such a case, then the slave would be able to have money and in fact would be required to purchase chulin and repay back keren v'chomesh to get a kapara for having eaten truma b'shkaga. The Mishnah continues on with more cases where there won't be keren v'chomesh. Here the case is ha'ochel trumas chutz la'aretz. If one eats truma that came from chutz la'aretz, meaning outside of Eretz Yisrael, we said previously that produce that grows outside of Eretz Yisrael, meaning in Syria, in Ammon or Moab, in Mitzrayim, and in Bavel, there's a rabbinic requirement to separate truma there. However, if one did eat such truma, bishkaga, he wouldn't add the keren v'chomesh. That is to say, that there is no, within the framework with which the rabbis required taking truma in chutz la'aretz, they did not require the keren v'chomesh surcharge in the event the one inadvertently ate such truma. That's not to say that truma midrabanan in general is exempt from keren v'chomesh. In fact, it's very possible that, as I said before, in the time of the Mishnah, all trumas is only midrabanan because the majority of the Jews were not in Eretz Yisrael in the time of the Mishnah. They had been exiled already 500 years previous and they hadn't really come back in the majority. And it may well be, according to many shitas, including probably halacha l'maisa, even in the time of the Mishnah, there's no mitzvah d'oraisa to take truma, it's just a rabbanan, and yet, of course, the Mishnayos are speaking about giving keren v'chomesh because the rabbis didn't, when they required the rabbinically to give truma, they did not relax the obligations of keren v'chomesh in the case of eating bishkaga, but they didn't set up such an obligation when it came to truma that came from chutz la'aretz. Finally, va'ochel pachos mekazayas truma. The fourth case is if one eats less than one kazayas of truma. So here, he is doing the eating, and normally said if one eats truma b'shogeg, he has to give back keren v'chomesh. However, that requires he eats it. Now, normally we said other cases where he feeds it someone else or he wastes it, etc. Here he actually is putting it down his throat. The thing is that for someone to be a legal ma'asa achila, a legal act of eating, it has to conform to a number of requirements. What he's eating has to be fit for human consumption, which let's assume it is here. We're talking about truma food. But it also has to be eaten a requisite quantity of food. And that requisite quantity is a kazayas, the volume of an olive. Think of a small matchbox, like a matchbox size, that kind of thing is a kazayas. So if the volume of food he consumed was less than a kazayas, even though he ate it through his mouth, it's not a legal act of eating. And that being the case, he won't have to give keren v'chomesh. Of course, if he ate, you know, whatever it is, 5 cents worth of fig cake, that's truma fig cake, but less than a kazayas, he'll have to give back those 5 cents that he took from the, you know, value that he took from the Kohen. But no chomesh needs to be added to that because he didn't do a legal act of eating. It's the same as if one would, you know, eat less than a kazayas of bacon. So then there's no lashes for that, no malchus for that, because it's not a legal act of eating. And although we do paskin, by the way, that a chatzi shir is aser medoraisa, we do paskin that, so it's forbidden to eat a half a kazayas of bacon, but one would not incur lashes for that act because it's not a legal act of eating. Same goes, by the way, just let me speak it out for a second, that a legal act of eating requires not just that it's in the requisite volume, meaning kazayas for solids and revius for liquid, but also that it's done within the amount of time that makes it a single act of eating, which Chazal said at Bechdei Achilas Pras, the amount of time it takes to eat, like a half of a loaf of bread, which works out to being somewhere between 2 and 9 minutes, depending on the shitas. But certainly if one ate a kazayas over the course of 10 minutes, he would not have done an act of eating and wouldn't be liable for keren v'chomesh. He would just have to repay what he consumed. This is just to illustrate the point a little further. It's the same if, for argument's sake, he took some truma grape juice and put a feeding tube straight into his stomach or an IV into his blood or something. In all those cases, it's not called an act of eating. And if he did that, so he got somehow managed to get the, you know, the truma into his belly direct, he would not be chayav to pay keren v'chomesh because that's not considered to be an act of eating. Okay, in all those cases that we just set up to now, the feeding of one's children, his non-Jewish slave, his eating truma from chutz la'aretz, or his eating less than a kazayas, the din is mishalem es a keren. One must repay the principal which he took that belongs to a kohen, of course, just as if he stole his bike or something, or broke his bike or whatever. Veino mishalem es a chomesh. He need not, however, pay the chomesh. V'tashlumin chulin. If he, the guy who did the feeding to the children, let's say, or the slaves, etc., if he reimburses the Kohen with chulin foodstuff, so in other words, I fed my child a cup of truma wine, now I'm going to repay you by giving you back your cup, a new cup of chulin wine, the chulin wine that I give you remains chulin. It doesn't become truma, even though it's to reimburse for truma, because that's only applicable when you're paying the keren v'chomesh. And therefore, since it's just a financial restitution and not actually, you know, a returning of chulin into truma, so then, imratza kohen limchol, if the kohen who was incurred the loss of, originally was his truma, that kohen can be mochel, meaning he can say, I don't want your money, I don't want your wine, I'm not interested in that, and that's sufficient. Meaning, as opposed to, as you said previously, if a person, bishkaga, inadvertently ate another kohen's truma fig, so then he will be obligated to return a chulin fig plus an extra chomesh worth of fig, and the kohen can't decline that. The reason why is because he needs to get his kapara, and the Torah is obligated to give keren v'chomesh regardless of whether or not the Kohen wants to be reimbursed. But here it's just a financial restitution, meaning, in fact, the person who ate the Kohen's truma fig who fed it to his child, etc., actually could just write the Kohen a check. No need to give an actual fig. It's just a matter of financial restitution. So, in that being the case, the Kohen is at liberty to say, I don't want your money or your restitution, and just decline it. Just saying, he could decline a check if you broke his or stole his bike, etc. And that being the case, imratza kohen limchol, if the kohen wants to be mochel and forgive the debt that you owe him for taking that which was his, mochel, he is allowed to do so. Trumos perik zayin, Mishnah Dalet 7:4. This Mishnah sums it up by saying, zeha klal, this is the principle. We're differentiating between intentional and inadvertent truma consumption. And the Mishnah says, kol ha mishalim keren v'chomesh, any scenario where the obligation is to repay keren, the principal amount, and add a chomesh, there's a requirement to add the chomesh. So for example, a person inadvertently ate 4 truma figs, he gives back the 4 truma figs, that's the keren. He adds a 5th fig, that's the chomesh. When such a scenario is required, so then hatashlumin truma, the chulin figs that he got, chulin musukanim, ready-to-eat figs that he gave, the 5 figs as compensation, let's call it, for the 4 figs that he ate, those 5 figs become truma and have to be treated with truma on a doraisa level. In ratza kohen limchol, and if the kohen from whom the 4 truma figs in my example if he want that you ate his figs, if he wants the mochel and say, you know what, forget it, I don't want your five figs, don't worry about it, eno mochel, he cannot do that. He hasn't got the rights, because one has to fix up the issue of the pasuk's requirement to return new truma to the world and add a fifth fig to it, add a chomesh. As opposed to v'chulat hamishalim es ha-keren ve'eno mishalim es ha-chomesh, any scenario where the obligation is to pay back keren, the principal amount, like in a case where one ate the mezid, ve'eno mishalim es ha-chomesh, but there's no obligation to repay a chomesh also, similar to if a case where he fed it to his children and so on and so forth. All these cases, the keren payment is just a financial obligation that belongs to the kohen, but there's no creating of new truma from chulin, and that being the case, hatashlumin chulin. That which is used to pay remains chulin. So for argument's sake, a person intentionally ate another kohen's four truma figs, he'll have to give him back four truma figs, not a fifth truma fig, because there's no chomish requirement, and those figs that he gives the kohen remain chulin, they don't become truma. And imratza kohen limchol, if the kohen says, I don't want your four figs, you're a thief and I want nothing to do with you, then mochel, he's allowed to do that. And a person then wouldn't need to pay back the four figs, he's off the hook. He'll still face misa b'dei shemayim if he ate it, that's for sure. He can't just get away from that by fixing up with the kohen. But that's true whether or not the kohen accepts the four figs. He has his own problems with Hashem. But in terms of the financial restitution that's required when one has to give back just keren, the kohen is at liberty to decline it, and that's totally within his rights, and that's fine. Trumos Perek Zayin Mishnah Hey, 7-5. This is a fantastic Mishnah, but you're going to have to concentrate, so you can't do this while you're driving. We're dealing with Sfeikus when it comes to Truma. Here we're talking about Truma Midurabanan, and that has to be the case here, because we're going to be relying on the rule of Suffolk Durabanan Lakula, that one is lenient when it comes to a suffix and uncertainty that arises when we're dealing with a non-Doraisa issue. And that's our case here. So in terms of the truma we're talking about here, the truth is, according to many shitas, as I said in the Hakdama, the introduction to this, the whole Masechet of Trumos, it may well be that even in the time of the Mishnah, the mitzvah to take truma was only a Durabanan, because the Jews weren't, the majority of Jews weren't back in the land of Israel, Yovel wasn't reinstated, etc. So, whether or not that's true, this Mishnah only makes sense, and it's only to be understood in the context of Truma Midurabanan. And the Mishnah says, Shtei Kupos, let's say you have two different buckets, Acha Shel Truma Va'acha Shel Chulin. One of them has Truma, and one of them has Chulin. Now, Shenafla Sa Truma L'toch Achas Mehen. And into one of these two buckets fell Truma. But you don't know which one. Ve'en yidua le'ezim en nafla. You just don't know which of the two buckets the truma fell into. So the answer is, the Mishnah says, Harei ani omer. You could say to yourself, L'soch shel truma nafla. You can say, let's call it arbitrarily, if you will, that the truma fell into the truma. Meaning, prior to the falling in, you had two buckets, one of which was truma and was usher to you, one of which was chulin and was mutra to you. You can assume, the Mishnah says here, you're legally allowed to assume that the truma that fell into the existing truma container, such that nothing has changed. The container that which was forbidden to you remains forbidden, and the container that was permitted to you remains permitted. The rule that's at work here is the governing principle is the halacha of a suffix durabanan lakula. When you have a doubt that arises with a rabbinic issue, and this we're talking about again, rabbinic truma, so one may be lenient. And the leniency here is a specific leniency here is called talia, which means, for lack of a better word, ascribing. Tole means to suspend or to assign. So here it's talia is to ascribe, to assign the truma to the existing truma bucket. Now that doesn't give you a carte blanche license to assign the truma to whichever is, you know, more lenient, which is more convenient to you. It's not like that exactly. That is to say, just for example, let's say we had two buckets, one of which had 10 units of chulin and one of which had 50 units of chulin, and the truma fell into one of those two. You are not allowed to say, well, it'd be much better for me if it fell into the 10, because then I still have 50 units I could eat. Whereas if it fell into the 50, then I only have 10 that I could eat. So you're not allowed to say, oh, let's just ascribe it, be tola it to the bigger one, excuse me, the smaller one, so that my big one's not messed up. No, you can't do that. You only can use this principle of taliyah, of assigning, when you have one container which is asur and one which is mutar, and that therefore, after you've been tola, after you've ascribed the truma to one of the two, nothing has changed. That is to say, the one that was permitted remains permitted to you, and the one that was forbidden remains forbidden to you. But to arbitrarily assign it to two buckets that are equally forbidden or equally permitted to you is not allowed. The objection to that is called, the jargon is called my chazis, which means literally, what did you see? Meaning, by what mechanism did you see fit to arbitrarily pick one over the other? So that is to say, and let me just sum it up here. If you have two buckets, one of which has truma, and the other one has either chulin, or it has in it Meiser Sheni, or it has in it Meiser Rishon, etc. So then you may say the truma fell into the truma bucket and not into the chulin or Meiser Rishon bucket, because right now one is permitted and one is not allowed to you. And similarly, if you had another bucket, whether it's truma, gedola, or truma's Meiser, or even meduma, a mixture of truma and chulin, and the other side is pure chulin, you again could ascribe, bitole, assign the truma to having fallen into that bucket of truma's Meiser, or meduma, or truma gedola, etc. You may do that, because again, you are keeping one heter permissible as it always was, and one usher to you as it always was. And this is a general principle when it comes to a suffix derabanan, that one can go lakula and ascribe bitole to one of the two, in this case, buckets, assuming again that one was always heter, one was always usher, and you're keeping things as they were. Which means, just to illustrate the point a little further, if hypothetically you were a Kohen and you had two buckets of truma, but one bucket was tahor and one was tame, and then some tame truma fell into one of the two buckets, and you don't know which one it fell into. So again, as a Kohen, you are within your rights to be, assuming we're talking about truma and midrabanan here, you're within your rights to be tole and ascribe the location into which that truma tamea, that tame truma fell, was the bucket of tame truma. Because before you couldn't eat it, and now you still can't eat it. Whereas the truma tahora, the other bucket, you could eat from, and you still can't eat from it. So that's what's going on in this Mishnah here. Okay, as a separate interesting point that comes up really in the Gemara, there's a question of whether the other bucket, the heter bucket, the chulin bucket, must have a majority of chulin even after the truma fell in. So that is to say, let's just say for argument's sake, you have in your chulin bucket, you only have half of a saw of grain. And in your truma bucket, it doesn't matter. You have truma. And let's say that truma fell into one of the two containers and you don't know which one. But let's say it's a whole saw. So on the tzad, on the possibility that the truma that's an Isra Durabban truma fell into your chulin bucket, you wouldn't have a majority of chulin. It's one part truma to half a part chulin, so it's mostly truma. So the question is, if that is the setup, so then may one still assume safely that the truma fell into the truma container and the chulin remains permissible? Or in such a case, does one need to at least also know that in a quote-unquote worst-case scenario, there was still a bittel, there was still a majority of chulin to annul the truma? And just as a slide point, in case you're wondering to yourself, well, obviously, if it was half and it was 1.5 units of truma, of course you can see, in the mixture, you can see that more fell in. So let's just say, for argument's sake, that after it fell in, you know, I don't know, half of it fell down the drain, or an unknown amount of what was in the bucket now got lost because the dog ate it. So you just don't know how much fell in the first place. You can't tell. Okay, but that's just a side point. So in the question of, do you need to have, can simply taliyah work on its own because of the rule of safek derabanan lekula be sufficient? Or do you need to also have, for your quote-unquote worst-case scenario, the possibility of bittul, the majority of what was in the heter container was already more than the Isra that fell in. So that's Machlokas, Rish Lakish and Rabbi Yochanan. Rabbi Yochanan. Rish Lakish holds that you do need to have a bittel also, and Rabbi Yochanan says, no, you do not. And the halacha follows Rabbi Yochanan, meaning you do not need to even have bittel. So you can say Safak Darban Lakula, even if on the if it worked out actually that the Isser, the Asr Truma fell into your chulun container, you'd have a majority of Truma. It doesn't matter. You can still be Tola, ascribe it to the other bucket, and eat from that entire chulun container now without any restrictions. Good. The Mishnah continues on now with a new case here, a totally new case. The case is that like you've got two containers, one had chulun and one had Truma, and then your kid plays the shell game on you and like mixes them up to the point that you just don't know now where the Truma bucket is and which one is the chulun bucket. They're mixed up. So now, how do you deal with those? So the Mishnah says, "Ein yadua le'eza hi shel truma ve'ezu hi shel chulin." You just don't know which is which anymore. So now, the din would be, and listen up carefully here because it's going to get confusing otherwise in a minute. The din would be that both of those containers now have to be treated l'chumra. You have to be afraid that each one could be the truma, and both have to bear within the restrictions of truma midurabanan. Okay? We'll come back to the question of why this is different than the previous case. But in any case, we'll treat both of them l'chumra now. The Mishnah says, however, achal achas mehen, if one, in fact, ate from one of the containers, so he wasn't supposed to, because let's say he's not a kohen, he has assumed it's truma and he shouldn't eat from it, but if he did, what's his obligations? The answer is nothing. Putter, he's totally exempt. That is to say, that in terms of having stolen money from the kohen, maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. Maybe he ate the Kohen's Truma, maybe he didn't. We'll never know. And the rule is, when it comes to financial obligations, Hamotzim b'chaver lav araya, the person who's trying to exact something from his fellow, the burden of proof is on him to show that indeed he's owed money. So in this case, the burden of proof is on the Kohen to bring evidence that this fellow ate Truma. And since the Kohen presumably can't, because it was mixed up in the shell game story, therefore, the guy who ate the truma will have no obligation to give anything to the Kohen, and that's that. Now, the Mishnah says nothing more but pater. So ostensibly that means that not only is the Yisrael, the non-Kohen who ate the truma, not obligated to make compensation financially to the Kohen, but ostensibly it also means that he doesn't even need to deal with the Karen of a Chomish business to get Akhoda Kapara. That seems to be but the Mishnah reads, and Lachor, that's probably the halacha lamaisa. The question is why, and the answer presumably is that for whatever reasons, the rules about the Karen V'chomesh, I'll call it the Kapara rules, follow in line basically with the financial compensation rules when it comes to a suffix. It's not perfectly clear why that would be the case. In fact, one could ask a very strong kasha and say that's impossible. Really, they're two separate issues, and even if there's no issue of financial compensation to go in, there still should be a issue of personal expiation of getting kapara, and that recipe for that is to give Karen V'chomesh, so it would seem that one should have to give Karen V'chomesh. And just to sort of flesh that out more, I'll illustrate with it with the case here, and that should really bring it to the fore. It's a different case here, but I want to bring it to the fore to illustrate this point. Let's say, for example, you are not a Kohen. Your father is not a Kohen, so you're not a Kohen. Your mother, however, let's say, she grew up as a Koheness, meaning to say, your maternal grandfather, your mother's father, is a Kohen. Okay, so that would make your mother, she had been a Koheness, a Bas Kohen, but she married your father who's not a Kohen, so you're not a Kohen. Which would mean that, of course, you're not a Kohen, and you may not eat Truma. And if you do, under normal circumstances, the obligation is you have to make compensation, give back to the Kohen what you ate, and do a Karen, not just recompensate him for what you ate, but also add a Chomesh, and do that from Chulun Mesukanim, from edible regular Chulun, and that will become Truma. Fine. What happens if, hypothetically, you inherited from your mother's father some Truma? So now it belongs to you. That Truma is totally yours. But all right, it's yours. You never took it from a Kohen, and you certainly have no obligation to give it back to a Kohen. Now, what you can do with that Truma, you know, is not much. You can basically sell it to another Kohen. You can do nothing with it because you're not a Kohen yourself. You can't eat it. You can't benefit from it. But let's say you do eat it. So if you do eat it, in terms of financial compensation, there's no one to compensate. The person who lost the value of the truma is you. It's your stuff. So you don't have to compensate yourself, of course. But the din remains that you do have to give keren v'chomesh because you need to still get your... It's when you ate it b'shgaga on accident, inadvertently, then you'll have to do keren v'chomesh to make, you know, the compensation to get your kapar. So if that's the case, it's hard to understand why it would be in our Mishnah, where we say a person who ate from one of the two containers, which may have been truma, why there's no obligation at all, he's totally pater. We understand why from a financial side of things, hamotzu mechaver lavaraya, the Kohen can't prove you ate his stuff, so you wanted to reimburse him. But in terms of the atonement component, the making the Karen Vachomish, it seems you should still have to do that, and yet the Mishnah says not. So while that may be true, that you don't have to do anything, because the Suffolk and the rules of Suffolk eating truma would follow these rules of Motzu Mechaver Lavaraya, it may not be the case. It may in fact be that the Mishnah holds you would have to give Karen Vachomish. It's just that Karen Vachomish that the Mishnah doesn't mention, you'd be allowed to sell to a Kohen, because you don't own anything financially to any Kohanim, but you still have the requirement to take Kohen and convert it back to truma. That may be the case. It's not clear. It's a Mechlokas in the Mechlokas Rishon. Okay, so in any case, so the Mishnah continues on. Vahashnia, as for the other bucket that might be truma and might be chulim, we don't know, that wasn't eaten. So we already said that it has to be treated stringently, and therefore, no hegba but truma. You have to treat it as if it were truma, meaning strictly like that. And again, I want to emphasize what I said before. It's not because the other one was eaten that you're ascribing truma to this truma status to this one. No. Even before either bucket was eaten, both buckets were suffic truma, and therefore both carried the stringencies as if they might be truma. So nothing changed. That's the point of the Mishnah. The Mishnah here just adds, however, v'chayevas b'chala. In addition to maybe being truma and therefore having to be strict for the truma possibility, it also may be chulin. And therefore, you have to be strict for the chulin possibility. What is the stricture when it comes to chulin? If what you're talking about here is flour that's generic chulin, so when you make dough out of the flour in requisite quantity, so one has to take a separate hafrasha, a separate, I'll call it a tithe, called the tithe of challah, and give that challah tithe, the hafrasha's challah, to a kohen. There's only hafrasha's challah when it comes to chulin. There's no hafrasha's challah when it comes to truma. So if you make flour from this container of wheat, and maybe the wheat is truma and maybe it's chulin, you have to be strict that it is truma and therefore Yisrael Hazar shouldn't eat it. But you also have to be strict and say maybe it's chulin and therefore you have to, when the Kohen makes dough out of this flour from this container, he will still have to separate challah, which of course he can eat himself. But he has to separate it. This is the same way if a Kohen just goes in the store and buys some, you know, flour in the store, when he bakes his breads, he'll have to be mafresh challah, even if he can eat it himself. But the point is he has to separate it. So that here, Rabbi Meir, Divrei Rabbi Meir, Shita is, you have to be strict for both, truma, and give it to a Kohen, and chulin, therefore separate challah. Rabbi Yossi, however, is poter. Rabbi Yossi says, in principle, it's true, maybe, that you have to be strict for truma and chulin, because you don't know, it's a suffix. But Rabbi Yossi has a separate shita altogether. His shita is that meduma, a mixture of chulin and truma, does not need to have any challah taken from it. And he holds that this scenario, we have two buckets, and they're mixed up, one of which is truma, one of which is chulin. Each one has a status of meduma, and therefore is exempt from hafrashas challah. If you're scratching your head and you're wondering, wait a second, there's no actual mixture here. This one is either entirely chulin, or entirely truma, and same with the other one. So then why would you call it meduma? That's a good question. And I think the answer is that the way Rabbi Yossi looks at it, when you put them, both of them together, you have a mixture. And in other words, you have two buckets, but if you put those two buckets inside a big, for argument's sake, inside a big box, so inside the box you have a mixture. Some of it's chulin, some of it's truma, you don't know which is which. And really, if you think about it, that's true with any meduma mixture. Let's say you have grapes that are mixed up and half the grapes were chulin and half the grapes were truma. So when you pull one grape out of the mixture, either it's totally chulin or it's totally truma, that one grape either came from the truma or the chulin when they got mixed up, and yet we treat that individual grape as meduma, because it could be either or, and that is meduma. So the same thing would be over here. You have two buckets, and each bucket is either entirely truma or entirely chulin, but the buckets then get the status of, each bucket gets the status of meduma, says Rabbi Yossi, and that being the case, he holds that a meduma mixture is exempt from Hafarshas Challah. Just note that there are Tanaim who hold that even so, and with a meduma mixture, it would still be obligated in Hafarshas Challah. The Mishnah continues on by saying, Achal Acher Es Hashnia, if now after the first one was eaten, the second container, which also equally is uncertain whether it's chulin or truma, was eaten by a second person. That second person is also patura. He's also exempt. Because just like the first person, Hamotzim B'chaver L'Varaya, there's no proof that what he ate was truma, and therefore he has no financial obligations. And similarly, ostensibly, he has no obligations to make restitution for the sake of kapara. And according to those who say he does, so he will. He'll add Karen V'chomesh from chulin, and he'll sell those similarly to a Kohen. However, achal echad es shtehen. However, if one person ate both of the containers, so now for sure he ate truma, because one of them had truma and one of them had chulin. We just don't know which one was which. The din will be mishalem kekatana shebeshtehen. He'll pay now the karen and chomesh of the amount of the small of the containers. That is to say, again, since it's hamotzim b'chaver l'avaraya, the burden of proof is on the Kohen. So the most he can prove is that at least the smaller container, Mamanoshach, either it was the smaller container, which had, let's say, 10, he'll have to, that's what was consumed as truma, or the bigger one, which contained, let's say, 20, could have been truma, but at least, for sure, at least 10 of the 20, no matter how you slice it, would have been truma, and therefore he'll pay Karen V'chomish of the smaller container, because he for sure ate at least that much truma. Pseches Trumos, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Vav, 7-6. This Mishnah picks up where the last one left off. We have two containers, one of which has truma and one of which has chulin, but we don't know which is which, so they're mixed up. So the Mishnah says, Nafla achas mehen l'socha chulin. So let's say, for example, we have the two containers, we'll call them A and B. One of the two is truma, one is chulin, we don't know which is which. But let's say now A falls into a third container, we'll call the container C. And that container C originally had chulin in it. So two possibilities. Either now C contains a mixture of chulin and truma, or C just contains chulin. It had chulin and it got more chulin inside of it. So what happens now is A and B by themselves each were suffic truma, midirabanan. And the din was, since it's certainly one of the two, A or B, has truma inside, we had to be strict. We couldn't treat them separately, and therefore we had to have the chumras, the stringencies of both truma and indeed, at least according to Rav Meir, for chulin as well. But the point is we treated both as if they were possibly, potentially truma. Now, when we have A, which is suffic truma, midirabanan, falling into C, which had chulin inside of it, the mixture in C now is not suffic truma, but suffic meduma. It's either nothing, it's pure chulin, or it's chulin and truma mixed together. And the din is that if you have a single batch of, in such a case, of suffic meduma, the din is eina medumaatan, it doesn't create meduma, meaning what's in container C is not treated as being a forbidden mixture, and one can eat it as if it's chulin. Okay, in other words, because the din is here, again, it's a suffix or a button, and we're going lakula, because the nature of the rabbinic halacha of meduma does not apply, they didn't set it up to include this scenario. In other words, they said it in such a scenario where it's only a suffix, if it's meduma, they were lenient. Now, vashnia nohegba, betruma, v'chayavis b'chala divrib meir. As for container B, which didn't fall anywhere, it had to be treated with the strictures of truma, suffic truma before, and meaning it could only be eaten by a Kohen and kept tahor, etc. And that still remains the case. At the same time, Rav Meir points out, it may be chulin, and if it's chulin, and you take, let's say, the wheat inside container B, and you turn it into dough of a requisite quantity, so then, even if you're a Kohen, but on the possibility that what you have in this container B is chulin, the Kohen must still separate challah from his dough. He could eat the challah because he's a Kohen, but he has to do the mitzvah of harshas challah. Rabbi Yossi is poter. Rabbi Yossi, like we said in the previous Mishnah, exempts the taking of challah from this. He says even though it may be chulin and may be truma, he looks at it as a meduma mixture, as I explained in the previous Mishnah, and Rabbi Yossi Shita is, when it comes to meduma, so there's no obligation to take challah. Fine. Now, naf l'shni l'makam acher, if the same way container A fell into, which was maybe chulin and maybe truma, fell into container C, which was all chulin, and we said that the new C, which contains C plus what was in A, we say is not meduma. If B now falls into container D, B, again, contained either truma or chulin, we don't know, and D contained just chulin, so it's the same as the previous case, and enem edematan, it won't, container D, which contains the combination of B, whatever was in there, maybe truma or chulin, and D together, won't have a din of demas, because it's just a meduma, because it's suffic meduma, and we said suffic meduma isn't treated as meduma. However, that's when we keep C and D separate, but in the case where A and B, one of which for sure has truma, falls into a container, let's call that container E, and container E had chulin, but now it has both the contents of A and B inside of it, and either A or B certainly is truma, so then of course now container E, which has certain truma inside of it, indeed, medumaos kaktana shebishtein, it has the status of meduma, and it's a forbidden mixture of chulin and truma together, but the calculation is based on the smaller of the two. That is to say, if for argument's sake, you had in container E 100 units of chulin, and now one unit of container A falls in, and 2 units of container B fall in. Well, there's a possibility that it could be B was the truma, and if that's the case, you don't have 100 times of chulin against truma now. But one can be lenient, and one can assume that the lesser of the two, meaning the A, which had 1 unit that fell in, was the source of the truma, and now you do have 100 times, more than 100 times, against that 1 unit of truma, and that being the case, one could be lenient, and the mixture could be eaten, and similarly, if one sells it to a Kohen, which you'll have to do with all 103, meaning the 100 originally there, excuse me, a different example where there was less than 100 times against, and he has to sell it to a Kohen, then he can sell it to the Kohen for the value of the total amount less the lesser of the two. So just let me give you an example of that. For argument's sake, container E had 10 units of chulin inside of it, and 1 unit of A falls in, and 2 units of B fall in. So you have a total of 13 now in container E. Well, it's possible of the 13, either 1 is truma or 2 is truma, because if A was the truma source, it's 1. If B was the truma source, it's 2. So now you have 13 units, and maybe 1 or 2 are truma. You'll have to sell it to a Kohen, because it's got a status of meduma, but you can sell it to the Kohen for the price of 12 chulin and a truma, not 11, because you can assume the less of the two. Again, the reason why is because, like we said in the previous Mishnah, the governing principle is when it comes to financial matters, hamotzi mechaver levaraya, the burden of proof is on the one who's trying to exact the money. Here the Kohen says he doesn't want to pay you, because maybe 2 units of the 13 are truma and you owe it to him. You can tell him no, he has no proof, so the burden of proof is on you, and until you can prove that it's 2 units of truma here, we'll assume it's just 1, and you'll have to pay for the other 12. Trumos, Perek Zion, Mishnah Zion, 7-7. This is the last Mishnah of the Perek, and it continues on with the discussion started 2 Mishnahs ago. The setup is we have 2 containers, A and B. Inside a container, one of the containers is truma, and in the other container is chulin, but we don't know which is which. So again, let's say it's wheat kernels, and one of A or B has truma wheat, and one of A or B has the chulin. Now, our Mishnah will consider what the rules are if one plants that wheat in his backyard, and it grows, it makes new wheat. Can one eat that wheat, or must one treat it as truma? So, just a bit of background. When it comes to proper truma, as opposed to suffic truma, so the rule is that if one plants truma produce in his backyard and something grows from it, so if he did it b'shogeg, inadvertently, he didn't know if he's planting truma, so then we'll let him, we won't let him benefit from what grows there, but we will allow him to till the soil, to plow over it, and start again. So he gains nothing, and at least he can make use of his land after the fact. If he was bemazed, he acted wantonly and purposefully planted truma in his backyard, so we give him a penalty, and he not only he can't even till the soil, meaning he has to let that produce grow, and when it finishes growing, he treats it as truma and gives it to a kohen. So he loses out in a big way. He doesn't benefit. In fact, the resource of his land is sucked up by the fact that he's growing a kohen's wheat as truma in his backyard. When it comes to meduma, a mixture of chulin and truma together, the rules are more relaxed, and we differentiate between the kind of seeds which decompose in the ground, they decay before they grow a plant, and a bulb, like an onion bulb, which you put in the ground, and it stays there, and the plant grows out of the bulb. So when it comes to meduma, if it's the kind of seed which totally rots in the ground before anything grows, so then we're lenient, and a person could not treat what comes out of that as truma, or suffix truma. If, on the other hand, it's the kind of thing which doesn't totally decay in the ground, like, for example, a bulb of an onion or garlic, so then we do treat that onion plant or the garlic plant as a truma, meduma, and you have to give that to a kohen. Now, our Mishnah is considering the case of suffix. Maybe it's truma and maybe it's meduma. So the Mishnah says, Zara es achas mehen. If one takes seeds from, say, container A, which may be truma, maybe chulin, and he plants that in his backyard, so then we say pater. We say he's totally exempt, again, because it's a motzi mechaver lavaraya, who says that it, anyway, what he planted was truma, maybe it was chulin, and we're suffix derban lakula, and that being the case, we let him, he's pater, he does nothing, he can eat what grows out of the ground. Vashnia, as for the second container, what to do with the container B, which he didn't plant in the ground. So, like we said in the previous two Mishnayos, no agba betruma, you treat it as if it's truma, you restrict with the strictures of truma, v'chayevus b'chala, and also you have to take chala from it, meaning the strictures of chulin apply. If one makes dough from this grain, as I explained previously, that's the Rav Meir, that's Rav Meir Shita, and Rabbi Yossi is poter. Rabbi Yossi says, like in the previous two Mishnayos, no, this container B has the status of meduma. And that being the case, Rabbi Yossi holds that meduma mixtures aren't obligated to give chala, so no chala from container B at all. Same as the previous two Mishnayos. The Mishnah continues on by saying, Zara acher es hashnia. If a second person planted the contents of container B in his backyard, so again, pater, he also will be able to treat what grows in his backyard as chulin, meaning each one of them can be treated independently, and each one can be lakula, and treat his growths as totally exempt from any restrictions as regular chulin. However, zara echad eshtehen, if one person planted the contents of both A and B in his backyard, so now we certainly know that somewhere in his backyard we have truma growing, and that being the case, we will apply the same kind of principles that are applicable to meduma proper and say, badavar shezaro kale, if we're talking about seeds, like wheat seeds, so since those are kale, they totally decompose in the ground before the wheat plant grows, so then mutar will allow him to eat all the wheat in his backyard. But uvadavar she'ein zaro kale, if we're talking about the kind of plant which the seed doesn't totally decompose before the new plant grows, like for example the onion bulb, so then asur, we restrict those onion plants and we'll treat them as truma, meaning this guy will have to give it all to a kohen who will eat it with the strictures of truma.